It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the four paragraphs that changed the American wine industry. I know, another one of those sweeping statements, but this one has legs. California wine got a huge kickstart because of one event in Paris in 1976. Our guest is former Time magazine Paris correspondent George Tabor. He's author of Judgment of Paris. For the Sterns, it's a monomaniacal luncheonette in Falmouth, Maine. Gourmet magazine's John Willoughby has the Coconut Chronicles. Then it's Eden in Iowa, Seed Savers Farm, where a living museum is literal. And we talk New Orleans, its patrimony. Can a culinary heritage survive a Katrina? All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
So that be no doubt, call on the north wind to come on out. Then cupped his hands so proudly to shout, la di da di da di dum, 'tis trees say they're tired, they've borne too much fruit. Charmed all the wayside, there's no dispute. Now shedding leaves, they don't give a hoot. La-di-da-di-da-di-dum. Then the birds got together to chirp about the weather. After making their decision in birdie-like precision, turned about and made a beeline to the south. My holding you close really is no crime. As the birds, the trees, and old Father Time, it's just to help the mercury climb. La di da di da di dum, 'tis autumn. The trees say they're tired, they've borne too much fruit. Charmed all the wayside, there's no dispute. Now shedding leaves, they don't give a hoot. La di da di da di dum, 'tis autumn. Then the birds got together, chirp about the weather. After making their decision in birdie-like precision, turned about and made a beeline to the south. My holding you close really is no crime. As the birds, the trees, and old Father Time, it's just to help the
Mercury climb. La di da di da di dum, tis autumn. It's just to help the mercury climb. La-di-da-di-la-di-dum. Tis
Lynn Rosetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today we have the French moment that turned the tide for California wine. Our guest, former Time Magazine Paris correspondent George Tabor, reports on that moment when the earth moved, at least in the Napa Valley. He's author of Judgment of Paris, California versus France, and the 1976 Paris tasting that revolutionized wine. John Willoughby of Gourmet Magazine fame talks Pacific Gold, cooking with the coconut. Then it's real grassroots biodiversity. We go to Seed Savers Farm in Iowa, one of America's largest collections of heirloom seeds. New Orleans journalist Pablo Johnson talks food culture surviving Katrina. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, you know, I am always checking out diners, and I know you're always checking out diners, but have you got a find for me?
Falmouth, Maine, just north of Portland, go to a restaurant on Gray Road called Harmon's Lunch. To call it a diner isn't quite right because most diners have a large and varied menu. Mm-hmm. Harmon's menu is one item and one item only.
One?
Well, actually, no, it's two items, but nobody ever orders the second, which is a hot dog. The first item is a hamburger. Everybody goes to Harmon's for the hamburgers. And in terms of options on the hamburger, you have only one, and a really important one, by the way, and that is what they called fried onions. Now, these are not crisp fried onions. Mm-hmm. These are what you and I would call sautéed onions, sautéed to a point where they're like just kind, almost like a caramel onion marmalade, and they are put on these hand-pattied hamburgers cooked on Harmon's grill.
That are buttered.
That are buttered, put in a soft bun. It's simple and perfect.
How can a business survive with one item, and in Maine, where there is lobster?
You know, that's a very good question. I imagine people in Maine at some point must get sick of lobster. I mean, I never have, but I don't live in Maine. So if you're kind of, want the carnivore experience, but you don't want a big fancy steakhouse, which is very antithetical to the whole Maine aesthetic. Yeah. Harmon's is perfect, including their charming little motto, which is "Let's get harmonized."
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the sign behind the counter where you order your hamburger, which says, "This is not Burger King. You don't get it your way. You take it my way, or you don't get the damn thing." That's my kind of restaurant.
Right. It's got that wonderful Maine sass to it.
So nobody says, "Do you want fries with that?"
No, actually, I was wrong. There are French fries on the menu, too. There is a side dish, and the French fries are really terrific. However, another sign behind the counter warns that during busy times, because French fries take longer than hamburgers and there is a limited amount of space in the deep fryer, if you order French fries, your order may, in fact, be delayed.
But that's why they're good, because the French fries are made in tiny little batches.
Oh, and I should say, I mean, lest we make this place seem austere, it really does have a wonderful decor inside, which is hundreds and hundreds of old-fashioned glass milk bottles, all from long-gone Maine dairy farms, line the walls everywhere you look. And there's something just fascinating about these beautiful bottles.
They're filled with, like, white paint. I mean, they can't possibly be filled with real milk from the 1940s.
I would doubt it.
Yeah, it's kind of milk-like something that's in them. But they, you know, they are very, very attractive. And it just makes you think, my God, you know, there must have been like 5,000 dairies in Maine, you know, and in the 1940s and 50s. It's just amazing.
What is this part of Maine like? What is that area like?
It's really country. I mean, it's great sort of inland Maine that many people who drive along the beautiful coast never see. It's farmland. And in fact, just north of Harmon's Lunch is a place called Pineland Farms, which is a 3,000-acre working farm where you can, our favorite thing to do there is to go to the bakery on the farm and eat baked goods, which are just terrific, including a great Maine whoopie pie. But in addition, you can go there and go horseback riding. You can take a tour of, and learn about different farming techniques. I mean, it's sort of educational. It's fun. You can have a picnic there. It's a real kind of, it's an opportunity to enjoy an inland Maine that travelers seldom see.
And good, as Michael said, good whoopie pies. Do you know what that is?
That's
Lynn?
What I wanted to ask. What is a whoopie pie?
Oh, it was invented in Maine in the
1920s. It looks like a hamburger, actually. Well, to me, on a bun.
It does kind of look like an inverted hamburger. But to me, it's kind of, imagine a giant squishy Oreo cookie.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Look, if you two don't agree, I'll never find out what a whoopie pie is.
It's two devil's food cakes in which is a bunch of cream, C-R-E-M-E, filling.
It's the size of a hamburger.
Yes.
And instead of the hamburger bun, I have no idea what Michael's talking about.
It's devil's food.
Oh, yes, it is.
The dark stuff
food,
is on the outside. The white stuff is on the inside.
Right, but it's huge.
It sounds
and the white
like,
stuff is
I think
fluffy.
Lynn is trying to talk to us.
Lynn,
yes,
be
Lynn.
Quiet. We're arguing.
I'm going to leave you both on that note.
Whoopee.
We'll come back to this.
We'll take this outside.
Yeah, we'll come back to this one day. Okay? Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern's classic guide, Road Food, has been recently updated. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. We had a Sterns moment ourselves a couple of weeks ago. We were in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Now, Cedar Rapids has the National Czech Slovak Heritage Museum. And around the corner is Czech Village. It's a charming street of old shops and food places. For instance, the Sikora Bakery sells kolache and has good goulash to go. At Zendrick's Czech restaurant, don't miss the cabbage rolls. But what really got to us was the first whiff of wood smoke. We followed our noses to the prime find, Polena's Meat Market. Now, they have been doing it all themselves for generations. The wieners, the sausages, the bologna, and they're all great. But the homemade Dutch loaf, that's what took me over the edge. It was standing there hot on the counter, perfectly seasoned, the juiciest meatloaf I have ever tasted. And no wonder, because one of the main ingredients is their home-smoked bacon. I ate Dutch loaf all the way home. And by the way, did I mention that Polena's prices are from another decade? Now, we're going to put the Polena's Meat Market's info up on the site, splendidtable.org. Willoughby does it all. He's executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, an award winner in cookbooks and articles, and he always seems to be following some new track about a food or a technique or a place. Hey, John, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back, man.
John, I'd like to talk about coconut. I was in the equivalent, you know, a little town in the middle of nowhere, East Earmuff, and there on a supermarket shelf is coconut milk. I mean, what's the deal with coconut milk? It's everywhere.
It is everywhere. You know, I think over time, certain ingredients from other countries work their way into the American pantry. And I think coconut milk has finally arrived. And, of course, coconut milk comes in many forms. You can see it unsweetened. It comes thin. It comes thick. But what it all is, if it's unsweetened as opposed to the sweetened variety, is really just you take the meat of the coconut and you heat it with water and then you press the solids and get the milk out of it. So it's really the water pressed out of the coconut meat. And if you find the unsweetened variety, that's what you're looking for. That's for cooking with. The sweetened variety is only for making drinks with.
Oh, I see. So the unsweetened variety is what I can throw into sauces and curries and
absolutely.
That kind of
you
thing.
Can throw it into all kinds of things. And it comes both low fat and regular. And I used to recommend the low fat because at that time they said that the saturated fats in coconut were very bad for you. But now they sort of changed their mind about that. So I would go with the regular, go with the full fat.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
It's got so much more flavor.
What about other coconut stuff? Like, there's dried coconut, but it comes sweetened and unsweetened. Is this stuff any good or is it just straw?
No, it actually isn't bad, and most brands of it are pretty good. It comes frozen, and it comes, at room temperature dried. Uh-huh. Actually, the frozen grated coconut, if you can find it, is a little more flavorful than the dried. But one way to use this is if you let it sit in water, just like one-to-one, let it sit in water for about 45 minutes, all the water will be absorbed. You're basically reconstituting the coconut, and particularly with the frozen variety, after you've thawed it, this works really well in place of fresh coconuts in recipes if you can't get fresh coconut.
Oh, that means I can throw it into a salad or something like that. It could really
absolutely
be cool.
It's a very nice product. And another thing that I found recently, which I had never used until just a few weeks ago when they made a recipe in the kitchen of the magazine, is coconut oil, which is the oil pressed out of the coconut meat without water. And this is really great stuff. It's just a cooking oil. You can use it as you'd use any other kind of cooking oil, but it has a sort of floral, light, sweet flavor, which is very distinctive and very delicious.
Coconut oil. So, I mean, would you use that to dress a salad even, or, sprinkle over papaya or whatever?
I would definitely use it to sprinkle over fruit because it's. I would use it in place of where you would use olive oil when you're doing Mediterranean kind of cooking. Anytime you're doing sort of South Indian or Southeast Asian or Caribbean cooking, I would use the coconut oil.
Now, when you talk about all of these things, like, for instance, when you talk about doing the canned coconut milk, is that comparable to making your own fresh from a fresh coconut?
Well, it's close. Some canned products are so close that unless you have a lot of time and you like to do things like this, it's worth using the canned products. And I think particularly the better brands of canned coconut milk are almost as good as what you make yourself.
Okay, so let's just say for argument's sake, I've gotten myself a bottle of coconut oil and I've got some coconut milk. Can you give me some specific thoughts about what to do with it, some dishes you really like?
I like to make a shrimp curry. Anytime you make a shrimp curry of Southeast Asian flavors, shrimp with the basil and mint and cilantro, and that you're just going to make into a sautéed curry and put on rice, I would put coconut milk in that. I like to put it in any kind of seafood soup. If you just put like a couple tablespoons of coconut milk into a seafood soup, it really gives it that sort of beguiling undercurrent of Asian flavor. You don't need to use a whole lot of it because it is a little sweet, but if you use just a little bit of it, it really adds a real sort of an undercurrent that people love.
Well, that sounds great. I wonder, can you boil it down and concentrate it?
You can, but the better thing to do if you want that is for most brands, if you take them off the shelf and don't shake them and just open them up, the coconut cream, which is the thicker part of it, will be at the top. And you can just spoon that out. And it's three times as thick as if you shake it up and mingle the two together. So if you want a nice thick coconut product with that little sweetness in it, use a couple spoonfuls of that.
I'm just thinking that with a little bit of honey over a piece of fruit.
Ooh. Wouldn't that be delicious?
Yeah, with
That's
dry
great.
Coconut on top and a little coconut oil in a pool on the plate.
There you go. That's the tropics.
Hey, John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and an award-winning food writer. Well, test drive this coconut information with John's recipe for fish masala. You can get it on the website. splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, each week we send you a quick worknight supper recipe. And we always have shopping and technique tips. But best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up at splendidtable.org. Coming up, The Judgment of Paris, Eden in Iowa, and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. Some wine pros claim four paragraphs changed the American wine industry. Now, those paragraphs appeared in Time magazine in 1976, and yet people still talk about them. They were written by the Time business reporter George Tabor. He was part of the Time Paris Bureau. Now, in June of 1976, he was the only journalist to attend a blind tasting of French and American wines. His book is Judgment of Paris, California versus France, and the 1976 Paris tasting that revolutionized wine. George, welcome.
I'm very happy to be here with you, Lynn.
George, how did you get invited to this thing? You were a business writer.
Yes, but I was also interested in wine, and I had taken a course in the introduction to wine course given at a place called the Académie du Vin in Paris, which was run by an Englishman who organized the tasting. And about a week before the event, which was really a publicity event, mm-hmm. to get attention to the wine school and also to the wine shop that he ran, there weren't any journalists going to attend it. So they called me and basically begged me to come. And I said I had nothing else to do that day. So if nothing more important came up, I'd be there.
Well, okay, now set the scene. Who was there?
Well, the judges were nine of the most esteemed people in the French wine industry. There were people like Raymond Oliver, who was the owner of the Grand Véfour restaurant, one of Paris's great restaurants, the sommelier of the Tour d'Argent restaurant, again, another great restaurant in Paris. The head of the Appellation Contrôlée board, which is the board that controls French wine. So they were very well and esteemed judges. The tasting was held at the Intercontinental Hotel in Paris. It was just down the street from the Louvre Museum. The room was a very small room. It was the wine tasting took place at 3. At 6 o'clock, there was going to be a wedding reception in that same room that looked out over a patio garden.
Judges, so you had to get out.
They had to get out. In fact, there was a lot of hustling to get out in time so that the wedding reception could get in.
Okay, now, I realize there were many wines, but can you give us a basic idea of what was being tasted, what was being contested?
Well, there were two flights, as they were called. First were the white wines, and they were Chardonnay in style. The organizer of the event, Stephen Spurrier, wanted to match off the best French white wines against California's best, mm-hmm. which he thought were the Chardonnays, and also on the red style, the great Bordeaux reds against Cabernet Sauvignon. So they started with the Chardonnay, and there were six California wines in the flight and four French wines, the same in six and four in the red wines.
So what happened? How did these judges react? I mean, did they, in this blind tasting, nail which ones were from California and which ones were from France?
No. And that was the biggest shock, I think, to them and to me. The tasting had gone on for maybe it was about halfway through the white wine tastings. when a couple of things started to happen. First of all, there was a lot more talking going on in the tasting than is normal at a wine tasting. Usually the judges concentrate very much. But the judges were kind of talking to each other, and at one end of the table would say, oh, this must be a California wine. And the other end of the table would say, oh, this must be a French wine. And I had a scorecard, so I knew what they didn't know. The wines had been put into neutral bottles, and the names in which the order of wines would be taken were literally pulled out of a hat, and then they were given a name like Chardonnay or Cabernet Trois.
Right.
And there was one just classic moment where Raymond Olivier lifted his glass, and he looked at it, and he swirled it around, and he smelled it, and he took a taste, and he said, ah, back to France. The only trouble was he had just tasted a Freemark Abbey Chardonnay from California. There were other things, more in the white than in the reds, that the judges were literally confused.
So who won? What was the winner in the white, and what was the winner in the red?
Well, the two winners were both California wines. In the white category, a winery known as Chateau Montelena won with a Chardonnay, 1973. And really, they won going away. They won by more than 6 points. And interestingly enough, in the white wine competition, every single judge had as his or her first place vote a California wine. On the red wine side of the competition, which came second, the Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon won. But this time the scores were much more close. Stag's Leap won by only 1.5 points over Chateau Mouton Rothschild.
That's a pretty interesting competition, though, when you think about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. No, I mean, nobody has ever challenged, nobody in the international market has ever challenged two things about this competition. First, that the judges were the highest that anybody could have gotten. They were very esteemed judges. And two, they had, I'm sure you're familiar with the 1855 classifications. Two of the four French wines are called first growths.
Right, and very prestigious.
The best of the French Bordeaux wines. And the other two were what are called super seconds, and they were second growths, the best of the second growths.
So have the French recovered yet, 29 years later?
Not totally. several of the judges still would not talk to me about the event, saying it was still too painful to talk about. Stephen Spurrier, though, has said that he thought the wine tasting was actually more important for the French wine industry than it was for the California wine industry. The event really put California on the map. But Stephen said that it was a wake-up call for the French industry that had been coasting for many years, and a lot of changes came to the French wine industry as a result of the Paris tasting.
Well, George, thank you very much.
I'm very happy to have been here with you, Lynn.
George Tiber is author of Judgment of Paris, California versus France, and the 1976 Paris tasting that revolutionized wine. The rain is coming down in buckets. The dirt driveway is Puddleville, and still it feels like we're on a movie set. We're slap dab in the middle of everybody's dream farm. Gorgeous meadows, orchards, forests, and classic perfectly tended plots of vegetables and herbs. Bright red kiss-me-over-the-garden-gate flowers reign amongst it all. Amish neighbors built the barn in front of us without a single nail. This place is straight from a glossy magazine photo shoot. Except it isn't. This is not a rich man's play toy. This is Seed Savers Heritage Farm in northeastern Iowa. This is the country's largest nonprofit center for saving living biodiversity, growing out heirloom food seeds from gardeners across the country. Kent Wheely is Seed Savers president and co-founder. You know that look we get in our eyes when we're doing the one thing that we're meant to do? Well, that's the first thing you see when you meet Kent. His beard is neat and graying. He's not young. But his energy radiates. Talk about a guy doing what he was meant to do. Well, he starts his introduction to this place at its heart. So this is what a seed vault looks like.
Yes.
Now, what exactly is going on in this room?
Well, there are about 25,000 varieties of vegetables that we're permanently maintaining here at Heritage Farm, and so these are samples of all of those varieties.
Now, it's cold in here. Do the seeds have to be kept cold?
Yes. The way we treat the seeds is to heat seal them into foil packets and then keep them in these refrigerated seed vaults. And it's also humidity controlled in here as well.
Now, are these seeds going to be sold, or are these seeds that you are preserving?
This is actually the collection of seeds that we have put together. So these are ones that we're just maintaining. And then we use the yearbook that goes out to our members to get these seeds out to them.
And that yearbook, if I remember correctly, always it has stories in it, doesn't it? Because you talk about who grew the seeds, right?
Oh, yes. The history that goes along with all of these seeds is incredible. I mean, there are varieties in this seed vault that supposedly came over on the Mayflower, others that were carried by the Cherokee over the Trail of Tears, tomatoes that General Lee sent home to his wife during the Civil War, lettuces that Thomas Jefferson grew at Monticello. So there's just a tremendous amount of history here.
Do these seeds have to constantly be planted and grown out?
Yes. The way we deal with it is we grow 10% of each crop on a 10-year rotation in order to maintain the seeds. So we're growing somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 varieties each summer just to multiply the seeds. What most people don't realize is that a seed collection like this has to be constantly regrown or the seeds die. For instance, if you were to throw a half-planted packet of tomato seeds into a drawer just at ambient temperatures, and they would die in about 4 years. But in conditions like this, they're stored so well that they'll last 40 or 50 years.
Kent, as you grow seeds in different environments, the seeds that perhaps General Lee and his wife shared, now they're being grown in Iowa. Are there changes that occur with those seeds?
There is selection pressure, we work with different organizations. For instance, Native Seed Search down in Arizona, mm-hmm. and they help us with some of the really long season varieties that we can't grow here. So we trade back and forth in that way.
So there is a network of all of you who are attempting to keep these seeds alive.
Yes. But this is a heritage of seeds that no one really knew existed and had certainly never been systematically collected until we started our work in 1975.
Can you show me now where you do the processing to get to this point?
Yes, well, part of the processing is done down in the barn, and then also we have a seed extraction machine and processing equipment out in the shed, so we can go look at both of those.
Okay, great.
Come this way.
Okay. Good Lord, the garlic. There's garlic everywhere. We're in a metal building, essentially. It looks like a small barn. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing garlic, but
yes.
I've not seen quite this much garlic before.
Yes, the entire farm here is certified organic, so all of this garlic is as well. But we've gotten to the point where last year we planted an area that would have been the size of 2 football fields, spaced 8 inches in each direction. So there are about 16 different varieties in here, I think, and a couple thousand heads of each.
So how do you go about drying the garlic and getting it ready for seeding?
Yeah, we've actually developed a new method. We used to tie it with twine strings and hang it, but now we just use a couple of 4-foot tubifores, lay one of them down out in the field, put the garlic plants that we have either dug or pulled mm-hmm. on them and just screw another tubifore down against them, and then we bring them in here and hang them on racks for drying.
I can hear a fan in the background. Is it essentially, it's very cool in here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually the only drying process that you use?
Yes, it is. But all of these garlics were dug in the end of July, so it was really hot then, but we do need fans to keep them from molding.
Kent, these are bulbs, but how do you process seeds? How do you go from the plant to that seed packet?
Yes, well, we actually purchased a seed processing machine, a seed extractor, and let me show you that.
Sure.
Okay. Watch your step as you come this way.
I want to stop off and grab some garlic. This garlic looks like it's ready to be photographed in a magazine. It is beautiful, and each tub seems to have a different type.
These are cucumbers.
They're yellow cucumbers. Big tubs of yellow cucumbers.
Well, actually, they turn yellow when they're over mature.
I see.
And we let them get to the point where they're actually soft. And then this is the seed extraction machine that we purchased in Holland. And these tubs are simply poured into that big hopper up there, and which grinds them up, and then one screen washes them through a stainless steel screen that's slightly larger than the seeds, and the next one is slightly smaller than the seeds and washes the rest of the pulp away. This has saved us so much time. One person can run about 20 of these large plastic tubs through in a half an hour, and before we had the machine, it would have taken our entire crew about 2 days to do the same thing.
How long did you work that other way, working by hand?
Well, we've been here since 1986, so we're just now getting the tools that we truly need.
We're talking handmade seeds.
Yeah.
Pouring rain. We're in the greenhouse. You can hear the rain just pounding on the roof. And this looks like a place that's habited by ghosts because so many of the plants are shrouded in a white plastic. What is that about?
This is actually called Rime, and it's a white fabric, actually, that is breathable. And these are lettuce plants, and we have to cover them in this way to keep the seed from being mixed as the wind blows through.
They're very promiscuous,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, they are.
I don't think anyone ever thinks of a lettuce plant as having a tall, pale, straw-colored stalk and white tufts of seed on the top of it. We just think of the green leaves.
Yes, if you've ever grown it to maturity in your garden or just let a plant go, you know how it sends up its seed stalk.
Now, what earns space in the greenhouse as opposed to out in the field?
We've been trying to use the greenhouse to grow a lot of our peppers because we have some varieties that are truly tropical from South America that we can't grow out in the field. They just need too long a season, and so this lets us multiply their seed.
So what does it take for a seed to get into the catalog?
Well, we go through these grow-outs of 3,000 varieties each summer, and just look for the ones that are superstars. And, I mean, it's really fun because you can walk down rows of tomatoes, and we grow 500 or 600 varieties a summer, and you can just see the ones that are incredibly productive and really lush. And so then we bring those back into evaluation gardens the next summer, do taste tests, and take more data. And then the very best of those are either grown here or contract grown for the catalog.
Why did you start doing this?
Actually, this happened because of a family seed. Diane's grandfather, actually, his parents had brought from Bavaria in the 1870s. And those were given to us very unceremoniously, but we realized that if those seeds were to survive, that it was up to us. And so then we started thinking that there were probably a lot of those types of seeds that immigrants had brought with them when they came to the U.S. And so I just started writing letters to the editors of gardening magazines and back to the land magazines, and it has grown from 6 members to 8,000 today.
What were those seeds, those original ones?
There was a beautiful little purple morning glory that had a red star in its throat that we just call Grandpa Ott's morning glory. And then a huge pink tomato that was Diane's mother had grew it to 9 inches across, and just hardly any seeds, just pure meat, and probably one of the best tomatoes that I've ever tasted.
Is that tomato still available?
Oh, yes, it's available through the catalog.
What is it called?
It's just called German Pink.
German Pink. Kent Willie, thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to show you all of this.
Kent Wheely is president of Seed Savers Exchange, which he co-founded with Diane Wheely. Now, for information on Seed Savers, go to the website, splendidtable.org. And no way am I leaving you without an heirloom tomato recipe. Find my fresh heirloom tomato soup with cream on the website, you know where, splendidtable.org. Now, those tomatoes and seed savers bring me to this week's trivia challenge. The question is, where did the Abe Hall tomato get its name? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question goes back to the Seed Saver piece and Seed Saver's annual yearbook. The question was, how did the Abe Hall tomato get its name? Well, this is kind of timely. According to a Seed Saver gardener, while his ancestors were riding out an Ohio River flood, one of them saw a pink tomato floating by. He grabbed it, planted the seeds. His name was Abe Hall. This is why I keep the Seed Saver's yearbook next to the bed. I mean, it's nearly a short story collection. For instance, the Cherokee bean came from a man whose Cherokee ancestors carried it on the Trail of Tears death march. An annoyed gardener tells us Maine's Passamaquoddy Indians grew the delicious Jacob's cattle bean, but that wrong-headed commercial catalogs always confuse it with Anasazi beans. Wrong tribe, wrong bean. Hannah's good-for-nothing apple comes from one tree in Hannah's backyard. It's 59 years old. No one has seen another apple like it, and it tastes so bad there's nothing you can do with it. Well, when each news cycle promises another insoluble problem, the Seed Saver's yearbook is where I hide out.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open and you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who is up first? We have Christy calling from Evansville, Indiana. Hey, Christy, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about potato pancakes.
Potato pancakes, okay.
Yes, I think people refer to them sometimes as croquettes, but my family always called them potato pancakes or potato cakes.
Okay.
And I have trouble making them. Are you familiar with the food I'm talking about?
Is this where you take leftover mashed potatoes and
yeah.
you make little patties out of them
yeah.
and you pan fry them, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Now, what's the problem?
Well, when I make them, they either turn out loaded with oil, you know, they really soak up a lot of the oil.
Right.
And so they're kind of soggy.
Uh-huh.
Or they end up burnt, or they end up falling apart. I can't get that crisp outside and that warm kind of soft inside.
Well, the first thing that occurs to me is I'm wondering how hot the fat is in the pan and what kind of pan you're using. Are you using a good, thick, heavy pan that conducts heat well?
I have tried this a million times, and I've used all of my pans. I've used the best pan that I have, but it's a very heavy-duty frying pan.
Right,
that you can
right.
put, you know, oil in the bottom of about an inch. I've tried nonstick pans. I've tried multiple things. I have a gas stove, so I can control my heat.
I think we have a potato-challenged situation here. Okay, I think a couple of things. First of all, one of the tricks that I love to use with this kind of thing is because it depends on your mashed potatoes.
Right.
And if your mashed potatoes are a tad on the dry side, you want to add something to help hold them together. So maybe it's cheese, maybe it's a little egg. Now, if you use egg, you want to cook it all the way through, obviously.
Okay.
And then what you do is you just pat them into patties, but pretty firmly pat them. Okay. And then I'd have a thin film of oil, no more than maybe a quarter inch at most.
Okay.
All right. And use something flavorless. You know,
okay.
And then I would put that over medium high heat. And the way to test it is take a little piece of bread. And if you drop the bread in it and it slowly turns golden brown, you're there.
Okay.
All right. Now, my mother had this trick where she used to roll the little potato pancake, as you're describing, she would roll it in cornflakes, believe it or not.
Oh.
And the other thing is you want to make sure the potatoes are at room temperature.
Okay.
But you don't have to have the cornflakes. The idea is you want to be able to put them into hot fat. If you're not putting them into hot fat or if you're crowding the pan, which will cool down the fat, that's when the potatoes absorb the oil.
Okay.
So you want that fat not smoking, but you want to see little ripples on the oil. A little ripple. And that cube of bread getting golden brown, not instantly, but, you know, over several seconds. So you put the potato pancakes in. Don't crowd the pan. Don't let them touch.
Okay.
And then I'd say let them cook until they're golden brown on the bottom. I would loosen them with a spatula to keep them from sticking.
Okay.
And then gently turn them. And I use two spatulas because I don't want them to fall apart.
Oh, okay.
Okay? And that should do the trick for you. But you want a pan that has good heat conduction.
Okay.
And that should help you.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, thank you very much.
You are more than welcome. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have got Ginger calling from Palos Verdes in California. Ginger, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. A couple of weeks ago, you guys were talking about heirloom spices. And since we're always looking for something different to do, I thought I would ask you about something called woodruff. It has driven me crazy for years. I have some, and I never know what to do with it. And I suspect maybe throwing it out would have to be the answer, since I have no idea. It makes me think of an anise smell, as in a pastiche. There's a French pastiche that's a Richard I use and, you know, flame and do something with a fabulous shrimp recipe that I have. But I just wondered about the actual spice.
Well, it's actually called woodruff or woodruff root sometimes.
Right.
But the reality is it's usually the leaf that's used. And
right.
That's what
I have, dried leaf.
Yeah, and you're bringing back memories of my misspent youth because years ago, this has probably been around forever, but there was a moment of 45 nanoseconds when May wine was very popular. And what this really was off-dry Riesling. A German Riesling could be from anywhere these days, that you put the dried woodruff leaves in and let them soak for a little wine, and you'd soak for a little while, and you would serve this chilled in spring. And it does have that just hint of anise to it that's lovely in a Riesling. But the reality is that I think anywhere you want that delicate flavor, I can imagine it with something like salmon, because, I mean, imagine, you know, you pan grill the salmon, throw just the smallest amount of cream and wine in there and a little woodruff root and boil that down, a woodruff leaf and boil that down. Mm-hmm. And you'd get that, just that little edge. But the idea is usually, if, you know, that's the one application I've always heard of with it is the May wine thing of steeping the wine with it for a while. And then you serve it very, very chilled. But I mean, when you're describing the flavor and I'm remembering the aroma of it, you know, the other thing you could do, and this might be kind of fun, is you could put it in, you know, in a little sack. I mean, it could be a piece of cloth that you tie right. it up in and drop that into the sauce.
Yeah, and I was actually thinking about that. In fact, I was to the point where I was thinking maybe the sack just goes in a drawer for a nice smell and forget the cooking aspect.
Well, you know, having Woodruff-scented whatever's in the drawer is not a very bad idea either.
Right.
But, you know, it is one of those things where it's a little... it's tricky because people just don't use it much. And it is, I guess, what you would call an heirloom herb. But I would try it in wine. Number one. And the other thing is I would try it in with delicate things. And I love the idea of it with creamy stuff. Not that it has to be cream, but something that has a creamy undertone to it.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
Chicken, you know, things like chicken and fish and that sort of thing.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. You're answering a question that bugs me.
You are welcome. I haven't thought about Woodruff root in ages.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ginger.
Bye.
Bye. You can call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We have got Emily calling from New York City. Hey, Emily, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. I am calling from New York, but I'm originally from Tennessee, and I recently inherited my grandmother's iron skillet.
Oh, boy.
I'm very taken with the idea of connecting to my southern roots through using my grandmother's iron skillet, but I can't seem to find very many good recipes. Just because a lot of my recipes use acidic foods like tomatoes, and I know that you're not really supposed to use those in iron skillets.
That's right. But if you get the skillet really well seasoned, what condition is the skillet in now?
It's definitely seen better days.
Is it rusted?
No, I mean, I've already seasoned it.
You have. Because once you get it really well seasoned, then you can do acidic stuff in it. It's almost like having a coating on it, which really you do. And the seasoning is a matter of, you know, using fat when you cook, usually some kind of oil. And when you're ready to clean it, all you do is hot water and you swish it around. And if you have anything sticking, a little coarse salt, and then dry it over heat, very low heat, so it doesn't rust. And I always rub it with a little oil and then just cover it with paper towel so that it goes into the, you know, cupboard like that. But these are the things you can do in it, okay? You can do any meat and any fish. And remember, you've got one of the best heat conductors in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know that whole blackened fish business that started years ago? Well,
right.
This is the kind of instrument that you can get searing hot and then take a piece of really nice fish that's maybe an inch thick. And maybe you've marinated it or you've rubbed it, but you have some fat in that pan and you plop it into that pan and that is going to crust up so fast. A cast iron skillet is one of the best heat conductors you will ever have. And then you can loosen it with a little flat, you know, metal spatula and flip it over and then knock down the heat and cook it slowly. This is the greatest pan to brown in that you will ever own. So anytime you're making a stew, anytime you're doing anything where you want a crust, I mean, this is a great place to, for instance, cook cabbage and onions with paprika and maybe a tad of bacon.
Sounds great.
you see what I'm saying? You know, broccoli, green beans, all of that kind of thing. And a little bit of acid isn't going to kill it, and you won't get a metallic flavor. But the more you keep seasoning that thing, the better it's going to be.
Okay.
And what a great thing to have from your grandma.
Oh, I know. I love it.
It's super. You are lucky, Emily.
I am. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Take care.
You too.
Call us, 800-537-5252. Cast iron skillet. This is probably the best all-time buy in cookware. It's right up there with the wok. This is the pan that never dies. This is the pan that maybe costs you at most $20, and you'll pass it on to your great-grandkids. New Orleans. Right now, those words stir up so much in all of us. First, the losses, the rebuilding. And then I find myself thinking about the patrimony of New Orleans. And that's when you can't sidestep the food of the Big Easy. No city in America cooks like New Orleans. No city in America drinks like New Orleans. And no city in America celebrates its identity like New Orleans. Award-winning journalist Pablo Johnson covers the New Orleans food scene. He's author of Eating New Orleans, a guidebook. He joins us from St. Martinsville, Louisiana. Pablo, thanks for talking with us.
Right.
You know, Pablo, for most of us, when you think of New Orleans, you think of the French Quarter and those grand old restaurants, Galatoire's and Antoine's, and of course there's Emeril's. Do you know anything about what's happened with them? And I mean, is there a good chance they're going to come back?
One thing that I do know is that Antoine's has sustained a fair amount of damage, not necessarily in the main dining rooms, because the main dining rooms took on just a little bit of water, but I think it's a 4- or 5-story building, and the wind had taken a huge chunk off the 4th floor and collapsed it onto the 2nd floor. So essentially what they have is a huge hole in the roof that is being patched up by tarps right now.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get back online. They're trying to figure out, you know, mainly when they get clean water. A lot of the restaurateurs who are trying to come back are actively looking at those basics.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're not going to instantly revitalize a high-dollar, you know, white linen restaurant scene. But in talking to a lot of the local chefs, Susan Spicer at Biona, Donald Link at Herb Saint, you know, these people are looking as soon as they can to return to New Orleans to just cook simple food, because they would rather, I mean, the feeling that I get from that is they would rather cook simple food in New Orleans than do basically high-dollar white linen stuff elsewhere.
And, you know, I'm sure they're worried to death about their employees, too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the restaurant community in New Orleans, even though it's it's a very large restaurant community in terms of percentage of the economy, is still very personal, and and it's still, people consider it a very small town in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that the chefs wanted to do as they were putting together the evacuation plans that they never thought they'd have to institute, they tried to stay in touch with all of their people, with their back waiters, with their dishwashers. And each one, especially in the early days, right after the storm, placed a really high priority in being able to track these people down and to make sure that they were in safe places. Another part of it is that the restaurant community is also really, a lot of New Orleans food is based on not necessarily the high-dollar restaurants, but the neighborhood joints, the po' boy joints, the little groceries, you know, the soul food places and the just the little grocery stores that have a lot of the city's simpler cuisine. We're not really sure what's going to happen to those either, and I think the time will tell. And, you know, we really, really hope they come out, because New Orleans would not be New Orleans without them.
Yeah. Pablo Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
Journalist and food authority Pablo Johnson is author of Eating New Orleans, From French Quarter Creole Dining to the Perfect Poor Boy. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this Hebrew proverb. Spread the table and the quarrel will end. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online at, you know, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.